Well, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Relapse and Recovery Workshop. Our speakers this afternoon are Natalie, Justin, Beverly W., and John K. They are here to share their experience with relapse and the strength and hope they found to recover. Each speaker will talk for 15 minutes, 13 minutes plus 2 minutes, and then you'll have like your 2-minute warning person right here, and if you go longer than 2 minutes, I'll throw the spotlight at you. As a courtesy to the meeting, please check to see that all cell phones and electronic devices are turned off. If you could do that now, please. Our first speaker will be Natalie, and would you just please qualify first?
Yes. Hi, I'm Natalie, compulsive overeater. And I've been in program for almost 20 years. It took me 10 years to get to my current 8 years and 5 months, and I've lost about 30 pounds. Did you want to go through
No,
or just start? Okay.
It's all about you.
It's all about me. Yeah, I wish I was life, but anyway. let's see. You know, I was thinking about what would, you know, be relevant to this workshop since it's about relapse and recovery. And it took me 10 years to get my 8 years. So 10 years is a long, long time to get recovery, you know. And, you know, basically relapse for me was hell. It was just hell. I was thinking of a word to describe. And because when I got here, I didn't take it very seriously. I never met anybody who was in program before. And so I just thought to go to a meeting here and there and something happens. Well, nothing happened. And I just got more and more frustrated, and I just thought, at one point I thought, if I just leave away, I'll never have this food problem, because I'm sick and tired of hearing people talk about their food issues. So so I left program. I had a 2-year relapse, and it was just so scary, because, you know, relapse for me was on all levels. Even though I'm not a 100-pounder, I could be. I mean, I remember when I was 176 pounds, which I'm very short, so that's a lot. I was thinking, I can go to 200. I can go even higher. It's not like there's a limit and then somebody puts a cap on it. And, you know, there are a lot of health issues. My doctor told me if I didn't stop eating sugar, I'd have diabetes. And, you know, so physically I felt horrible, just absolutely horrible. My body was completely out of shape. And, you know, breakfast was usually good, but 11 on, it was just sugar nonstop. And, but, you know, more than physically, if I was just, you know, and I joke about it, but I'm really serious. If I was just fat, I'd just deal with it, you know? I'll just be like, okay, I'm going to be fat the rest of my life, and life goes on. But that's, you know, but it's the other stuff that really got me to program was the emotional and spiritual, just the torment. Every day I had issues with people, and every day was just so difficult to get through. And I had so many resentments all the time, and it's kind of like the part in the Big Book where it talks about, you know, the tornado running through other people's lives. And when I came back to program after that 2-year relapse, you know, I didn't realize how crazy and out of control I was. And, you know, now that I'm in recovery, I see like, oh my God, I can't believe anybody would have been my friend at that time. Because, you know, thinking about other people, taking other people into consideration. I mean, my life revolved around me, and food. And which is very sad, you know, and thank God that's not the case anymore. 9.5 years ago, I went to a weekend, and it was all about relationships, and I realized that my life's just going to be screwed if I don't work an OA program. Just to have good relationships with people, forget about dating. And so I came back to program, and it took like 6 months to get off sugar. And sugar was really, really hard to get off. It's a real addiction. And, you know, sometimes I see people eating sugar, and I think, oh, you know, what's the big deal? Well, the big deal is, you know, other people can have one. You know, like my nephew, and those of you who were here yesterday, I mean, the kitchen sink, then you'll hear about him again. But, you know, he just eats one of whatever, or the whole box of whatever, and his life goes on. He does not think about that box for the rest next 2 years. Well, I do. I mean, I start with one, and then maybe I don't eat in front of you because I, you know, that's not really polite, blah, blah. And, you know, but then I eat box and another box and another box, and it just gets worse and worse, and it was very, very, very scary. So it took me 6 months to get off of sugar, And then it took me quite so many years to get off of white flour because I was just very, very, very resistant. I just thought, you know what, there's another program where they're very strict and I'm not going to be like one of those, you know. I'm just not going to do it, and I'm just not going to do it, and I'm kind of like, a two-year-old. I'm stomping my feet. It's not going to happen. No, not going to happen. Well, I couldn't get abstinent for 30 days, and it kept on happening and happening. You know, every 20-something days, relapse. 20-something days, relapse. And I'm, physically I felt horrible. Emotionally I felt horrible. It was just this whole cycle. And finally my sponsor said, well, what do you think you need to do differently? And I said, I think the two things I need to do differently was give up white flour and call three people every day. And for me, calling three people every day is really like a change because I'm an isolator and I don't want to talk about what's really going on because when there are problems, it's like I'd rather hide, But the problem is I can't be abstinent and not talk about what's going on. It doesn't work that way. So starting to call people every day and really talk about what's going on and talking to my sponsor was a real major shift. And then giving up white flour was actually really, really easy once I made the decision. But making that decision took like a lot, many years, because I'm very, very stubborn. So, and then the last few years being in recovery, it's like I cannot imagine life otherwise. I just cannot imagine because there are so many gifts from being in recovery. First of all, and it's gotten better, but I don't obsess about food every meal and every day and how I look and all that. And my relationship with other people has improved tremendously. I can be present there for other people, for my family and for my nephews. And I can be present for life. I mean, it used to be that people used to talk to me and maybe it looked like I was listening, but I wasn't listening to anything you said because I was too busy thinking about whatever. I mean, I don't know if it's in the 12 and 12 or the big book where it's like narcissistic to the extreme. I never thought of myself that way because I'm such a good girl and all that, but, in the reality, that part where they talk about selfishness, self-centeredness, that really, really applies to me. And if I remember it, and say the sixth and seventh step around it and talk about it with my sponsor, it gets better. But my character defects are still there. It's not like they've gone away. They have not gone away. But they have lessened. That's the good news. And when they do come up, I can, make an amends or just, change any of my behavior or something. So it's not just I can't just walk on people or walk on, have that tornado walk around. Let's see, what else? How many minutes is that? 7 minutes. Okay, so that's half my time. For me, the other decision was making OA the number one thing in my life. To me it really doesn't make sense, and I think I'm an intelligent person. It's like if I make OA the number one thing in my life, then everything else falls into place. Then I have good relationships with other people, with my family, with coworkers, and everything. But when I start putting OA when I have time, well, there's never, do I always feel like going to a meeting? Do I always feel like talking to my sponsor? Do I always feel like talking to my sponsees? Do I always feel like doing whatever? No, but if I felt like, if I did stuff based on when I felt like it, it would never happen. Did I want to get up this morning to take the dog for a walk, before I got here? Not really, but it's like, if I think about what I need to do, then I don't do it. But if I just do it, then, it's just a lot better. Because thinking is not a tool in the program, It's like, let's see, my current program is I go to about 4 meetings a week. I have service commitments at 3 meetings. I have a sponsor, and I have about 3 sponsees every day. And, I do my morning OA stuff and my evening OA stuff. And some of the things that have really helped me is I go to meditation classes. I just started that about a year and a half ago. And, the 11th step where they talk about prayer and meditation, I didn't realize how important that is. And especially for somebody like, I get anxious and type A personality and all that. So it really helps me to calm down, meditation really, really helps me. And then the other thing is also praying for acceptance. Because, there's still a part of me and I don't know if it's ever going to go away, that I want life on my terms. You know, I want people to do as I want them to do, and that's never, ever going to happen. So, you know, when I pray to accept things as they are, to accept other people as they are, then it just, the day just goes better. You know, yesterday was one of those long days, and when I pray to, you know, for my higher power to help me get through, it just makes such big difference instead of me trying to will my, you know, my will and power and all that, you know, crap to, you know, to get through. Let's see. Well, I know I talked about this yesterday, but whoever listened to this yesterday, then that's fine. But, so I have a 4.5-year-old nephew. And the reason I'm talking about him is because there are a lot of similarities between me and him. And I didn't realize that there were similarities until, you know, I hang around him, and then my sponsor says, you know, you're acting like you're 4 years old. And I'm like, no, I'm not. I just don't want to do whatever you're telling me to do, you know. And so, you know, I mean, some of the things that are similar, and I say about it, and it's kind of a joke, but it's really true. You know, when he doesn't get his way, he just throws a fit. I mean, life is going to stop. You know, he did not get what he wanted, whether it's this Buzz Lightyear toy or Nemo or whatever. I mean, life is ending. And that's how I feel inside. You know, I don't act out the way he acts out, and I don't, like, jump and on the floor and, you know, scream and all that. But inside of myself, I'm like, I want things my way, you know? And, you know, a couple of weeks ago I was with him, and he was saying, he was very bored, so he's like, what are we going to do now? What are we going to do now? What are we going to do now? And that's how I think inside, you know? I mean, I go to work all day, I'm a responsible adult, but all day long I'm like thinking, what fun thing can I do? All day long I'm thinking about fun, you know, and not all day, every day is fun. I mean, you know, it's just, you know, you know, when I go with him and eat something, he just, you know, he eats, and it's more important for him to play. And when I grew up, it was more important for me to eat than to play, you know. And that already shows how I was riding my disease right from the beginning, you know. Yeah, so I don't know how much more I have to say about it, but I'll just say that, you know, I'm really, really grateful to Program. I can't imagine my life without it. And it is possible. It took me 10 years to get my almost 8.5 years. And, you know, I still have to work at it. It's not like, okay, now I'm cured, you know, great. It's not like that at all. I still have to work at it every day. And I think the biggest thing for me now is I'm going through my fifth step again, which is probably the fifth time I'm doing it. And it's very, very humbling. This program, every time I'm going through the steps, it's like, I've heard this another layer, which is so cheesy, but, you know, it's like every time you learn more and more, and I see why I used to overeat, because I can't be a selfish, self-centered person and walk over other people. That just doesn't work if I want to be in recovery. So I think I'm done, and thank you for asking me to speak, Kelly.
Okay, our next speaker.
You're not anal.
Okay, our next. That was John Kay.
He's in recovery.
Our next speaker will be Justin, who will now qualify and speak about his experience with relapse and recovery.
Hi, Justin, compulsive reader.
Hey, Justin.
Because I'm long-winded, so I need to see my time, because I'll just keep going and going and going. Hold on a second.
I've got a non-traditional, so I might be off by it.
That's all right. That's quite all right. Okay, here we go. Justin, compulsive reader, still. I've been in program, it'll be 5 years this coming July. And, you know, I came in, was abstinent for a year and a half, then I relapsed for 2.5 years, and my current abstinence, I'm at 345 days today. I, you know, my physical recovery has most of it's been this year. So far, I've lost about 130 pounds. I used to be a type. What class is 130 pounds? No, I need to do that because I'm very much like, whatever. So let's talk about, I don't give that, because it's a miracle. I mean, it really is. I've never, it's crazy. Wow. Yeah, what it used to be like and all that kind of stuff. Very similar to most of your stories. Relapse is a process. It's not an event. It does not just happen one day. Like, from my experience and from what I've heard from other relapsers, like, you typically don't just wake up and say, oh, screw it, I'm going to go to McDonald's and order everything. That's not what happened to me. I was abstinent for a year and a half when I first got in the program. I was one of those people who struck abstinent. You know, it was very much like, just tell me what to do, I'll do it, you know, show up and I'll do it. And that's what I did. But, you know, that first year and a half, the biggest difference between my abstinence now and then was I did not get that this is a spiritual program of recovery. You can focus on the physical, you can focus on the emotional, but for me, if I don't focus on the spiritual part of this program, I am going to eat, plain and simple. So I was doing all the things. You know, I'd go to meetings, I was like, you know, timer or something at a meeting, and, you know, I'd call my sponsor every day, I was writing out my food, I was doing all the stuff that I was being told to do, but I was not praying and I was not meditating. I was really not trying to seek a closer conscious contact with God. I was raised in a house that, you know, my mom, she'd take me and my brother to church every Sunday. I had a huge problem with organized religion because even at 8 years old, I couldn't understand how if I prayed to an all-knowing and all-loving God, and he's supposed to love everybody and create everybody, but if you don't pray to him, you're going to hell. I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. What about, like, the Buddhists and, like, the Taoists and, like, the people who live in, like this doesn't make any sense. That's why we have missionaries. I'm like, this doesn't work for me. So, I was just kind of like, whatever. And also because of my own self-will, I refused to go to a place and have some dude in a robe lecture to me about my spirituality. Not going to happen. So that's what it was like for me. My relapse started the summer of 2007. I'd moved back. I'd moved out to Los Angeles 2006. Had been here for a year. I moved back home to Florida, which is where I grew up, really quickly because my dad was dying of cancer. My dad, man, I am my father's son. I'm very much like my dad was in a lot of ways, but also very different in some ways. We had a very contentious relationship when I was growing up because I now realize it was hard for him to see himself in me every day. And so we were always butt heads. And it wasn't until I was an adult, really the last couple years of his life, that we started to have an adult relationship. So when he was diagnosed with cancer and with terminal cancer that March, February 2007, he then passed away December 2007. So it was very quick. So I'd moved back home really quickly because he was dying. And I spent that entire summer with my dad because my mom was working. My brother, who's autistic, worked nights and really couldn't do much. So I would pick my dad up every day, take him to breakfast, take him to chemo, take him home, and basically just be with him that entire summer. And my relapse started at a, I was actually moving after that summer in the fall, I was going to law school, which was a huge deal for my father because my dad was a sitting judge when he died for almost 30 years. He'd always wanted me to go to law school. Our plan was when I graduated, he'd retire from the bench and we'd open a law firm together. And it really didn't matter what my dad did. My dad could have been a bricklayer. I would have gone out and learned how to lay bricks. I mean, I just loved my dad so much. I just wanted to do whatever. Because I don't want to be a lawyer. God, I'm not a lawyer today. God forbid. Anyway, that's a whole other shit. So it started when I moved to Gainesville to go to law school in August. And I was moving into my house and doing all that kind of stuff. And I was hungry, and so I went to this fast food drive-in place, like it's one of these drive-in, old kind of drive-in kind of things. And, I ordered like a chicken wrap, which I can totally eat. It's totally in my abstinence, but eating at fast food restaurants, not in my abstinence. Now, I was taking care of my dying father, had just left him to go start a get my law degree, which I didn't want to do. I certainly wasn't talking about it. I had stopped calling my sponsor. I definitely wasn't writing about it. So I had all of these emotions, and like my spirit was dying a slow death, and I wasn't doing anything about it. I was able to kind of hold on and white knuckle through, you know, kind of my first semester in law school, going back home, seeing my dad, you know, literally wasting away. Like, my mother couldn't see it because she was there every day, but I'd come back every few weeks, and literally, I had a friend die at the beginning of November of that year, and I was there for her funeral, and then I came back home 3 weeks later for Thanksgiving, and my dad had probably lost about 50 pounds in 3 weeks. And I knew when I saw him at Thanksgiving that was probably the last time I'd be able to talk with him. But the day after I left, my mom called me and said, "You got to come back home." And so I was able to go through everything, like arranging the funeral. It's crazy because, like, God was still working in my life, even though I was not connected, because, like, I was able to do everything that I could do just to get back home to take care of everything that needed to be taken care of. One thing I couldn't do was bring my suit. I just could not bring my suit back home, because it's like, if I brought my suit, then my dad was definitely going to die. I just couldn't do it. So I was doing everything else, taking care of, going to the funeral home, everything, and then it was like, the day he died, I finally was like, okay, I guess I have to go buy a suit. So I went to the store to buy a suit, and it turned out the guy at the store was an old friend of mine that I had literally not seen since I was 17 years old. I had to get this thing done. They had it altered. They had it delivered. They called the UPS people to have it brought there, like, that morning. Like, they just went above and beyond, because the woman who did the ordering actually used to work for the justice system and knew my dad. Like, this... God was taking care of me. He was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. So I went through all of that, and it was like, after that, you know, it was like Christmas and everything, and I just finally was like, I'm done. I can't do anymore. I was not actively suicidal, but I didn't want to live anymore. I just was done. My dad, the person who I loved the most in my life in this whole world, was not here anymore. I saw no point in going on and what I would do, so I just started eating, because I'm a compulsive overeater. And so 5 months after that, I found myself in the hospital with 1,000-point blood sugar. For those of you who don't know anything about diabetes, you can lose your eyesight and limbs at 500. Mine was 1,000. It's another miracle that I wasn't not only not dead, but I was actually still conscious. I really should have been at least in a diabetic coma, but I wasn't. So. Even after this, like, this disease is so cunning, baffling, powerful. Even after going to the hospital and spending 3 days in the hospital just to get my blood sugar down to, like, 330, I think it was, when they released me, I had to eat for 2 more years. I had to eat. I had to give myself insulin every day, and I had to take pills, which, not to be graphic, literally, I had diarrhea for a solid year. And I remember thinking to myself, I can't live like this. God, I'm going to, like, my colon is going to fall out of my body if this has to be for the rest of my life. You know, like, I can't do it. And I guess that was kind of like a prayer of desperation, because, like I said, God never left me. A year after taking insulin and all this stuff, I didn't have to take it anymore. After just a year. I was still eating 10 to 12,000 calories a day. I mean, what that looked like was, it was probably about 3 to 4 very large meals from McDonald's, Taco Bell, Burger King, and Wendy's, all those, like, fast food, I mean, just by the sack full. I wasn't much of a sugar person. Like, sugar was always, like, the proverbial and sometimes literal icing on the cake after a good binge. But no, it was really, like, the cheap, nasty junk food. By the time I got through, I ate my way through law school. I was almost 500 pounds. I say almost because I really don't know how much it was, because by the time I was actually willing to get on a scale, it was a 450-pound scale I didn't register, and it took me 3 to 4 weeks of losing 5 to 8 pounds a week to actually register at 449. So I could have been 470, I could have been 480, I might have been 495, I really don't know. But I got back in the program after I finished law school, and, you know, it's funny because I was at this place in my life where everything was gone, you know? Like, I'd finally done the thing in law school. I did that for my dad. I did that for my mom. This woman that I was dating was totally, like, sorry.
This woman that I was dating, like, you know, she broke up with me via email. Yeah. So, yeah, that was a great relationship because that's who I pick. People who don't, I didn't feel that I was worthy enough for love and acceptance because I didn't love and accept myself. So, of course, I'm going to be with somebody who doesn't love and accept me. So I was just at this place where, like, life was horrible. It was totally unmanageable. And I heard this little voice in the back side of my head said, what am I going to do with my life? She's like, you need to go back to OA. And I was like, okay. And, I mean, literally, it was just like that. I moved back, you know, I moved back to Los Angeles, got back in a program. It all happened so quickly that my friends didn't even know where I was. Like, they thought, like, I was going to move back home to Fort Myers, I had the job waiting, everything. Wait, no. Like, coming back here and getting back in the program was so much more important because at that point I knew it was my life. My last binge was in Las Cruces, New Mexico on July 1st. Well, June 30th, July 1st. My abstinence date is actually July 2nd because I did remember that the next morning I did have to go back to McDonald's and have that McDonald's breakfast that one last time on July 1st, so it has to be July 2nd. Las Cruces, New Mexico. Maybe I'll go back there on July 2nd, see what it's all about. Maybe not. So yeah, what it's like today, it's so completely different because this is a spiritual program of recovery. I was not willing to let God into my food before. And yes, I was abstinent for a year and a half, but like I said, I was just going through the motions. I pray and meditate every day. I try to every day. The days that I don't, really bad things happen to me. Been in car accidents on the days that I've not prayed and meditated. Had huge pieces of glass shatter in my hands when I've not done this. Horrible things. And I've said, God, I know. I don't know why I keep not doing this. I will do this. You keep showing me that I need to do this. You know, I call my sponsor every day. I commit my food. I do a daily 10 step. I've been working through the steps. Before that first year and a half, I was doing a 1-2-3 step. Would never do my fourth step. I did my fourth step this time, and my fifth step. I actually finished my whirlwind ninth step amends tour a couple weeks ago, making my amends. Yeah, and that was. Let me tell you about this little. I'll end with this. This is amazing. That was amazing because, number one, I went back home to where we spread my dad's ashes. For the first time, I went to that place 3 years since we'd done it, and I wrote my dad a letter. All of the anger, hurt, resentment, the things I've left unsaid, like, I never told my dad that I loved him while he was alive, you know? And I'm not hard on myself about that because that's the kind of house I grew up in. My dad never told me he loved me, you know? I can count on one hand the number of times my mom would tell me that, you know, as a kid. Which is weird because as an adult, my mother's been like, I love you, da-da-da. And before I was in program, I'm like, okay, whatever. I don't know what to do with this. But now that I'm in program, and now that I've got these tools, when I made my amends with my mother was the scariest because my mother's the one that I've treated the worst, the absolute worst. The things I've done and said to my mother over the years, I mean, I'm very ashamed of, very ashamed. So when I made my amends to my mother, and my sponsor was very specific, I had to write everything out, and I had to ask these two questions. You know, did I leave anything out, and what can I do to make it right? And my mother really surprised me because, you know, I've shared in meetings before, my mother's done a lot of things this year. She's met somebody, gotten remarried, and da-da-da-da, and it's been really fast, and I've really didn't have to be, but I chose to be in acceptance of what she was doing and supported her. I acted as if. Because I honestly, when she told me, and I met the guy, and he's like, oh yeah, by the way, we're getting married in 3 weeks, I was pissed as hell. But program said, hey, acceptance, you know, act as if. And eventually, you know, the feelings came, the guy's a nice guy, she's happy, it's great. But she told me when I made amends to her that everything that I had been doing all year by supporting her and everything that she's done has been amends enough. And that she was able to realize that the things that she was doing probably wasn't the best way to do them, and that I would have probably had negative emotions towards that. And she really was like, no, tell me if I've hurt you. And I was like, Mom, you know, you're living your life. I'm happy that you're happy, and I love you for that. And it's like, it's crazy, but I actually can say to my mother that I love her, and I can actually feel that I love my mother, which is huge for me because I have never, ever in 32 years, felt that I've loved my mother, and I've never felt that she's loved me. And that's what this program is giving me. Thank you. Okay, that was Justin. Thank you for being of service. And just for those of you listening to the CD, when you hear that alarm go off, that is John Kay standing up and wiggling his tushy at the crowd. Okay, our next speaker is Beverly W., who will now qualify. You are anal.
No,
okay, it's Beverly W., who will now qualify for relapse and recovery.
Hi, my name's Beverly, and I'm a compulsive overeater.
Hi, Beverly.
Hi. And, thank you, Ellie, for asking me to be here today. It's an honor. I'll qualify. The first time I went to an OA meeting was about 1983, and I sort of didn't really totally get what was going on here, and I had a lot of other things to do. I was sent here by a therapist. But I was sent to other 12-step programs by therapists, so I just kind of played around for a while. 1986 was my first abstinence. I lost 60 pounds very quickly, became a speaking star all over the place, and I, you know, it was all about my weight loss. But I did keep that weight loss for probably about 10 or 11 years. I kept the weight loss off for about 10 or 11 years, but eventually I stopped going to meetings. But the main thing that happened is during my first abstinence, I had to keep my mother out of my life. I know this was very controversial at the time, and I had a lot of problems with people telling me, oh, she's the only mother you have. And you know what? My mother was an alcoholic, and she had borderline personality disorder. And there was absolutely no way for me to communicate with her unless it was about her. So when I let her back into my life, my program friends were kind of nudging me, saying, you know, you're putting on weight, and I was. And eventually I stopped going to meetings, and my relapse lasted for 10 years. I stayed out there for 10 years, and the first time I came in, I was 183 pounds. The second time I came in, I was 232. That was the last thing that I counted. A big part of my story is about my relationship with my mother and how I had relationships with other people was not very good either. So it's hard for me to project my voice, but I'll do the best I can. Anyway, I don't remember exactly when it was, but my mother got ill, and she needed to be cared for. At the same time, my stepfather was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And during this period of time, when I was already, I had gained all the weight, I had no defenses to, you know, I said yes to everything. So I would take on any responsibility that was in front of me, and I decided it was my job to take care of all these people. So I took care of my stepfather until he died. I took care of my mother for 5 years in a wheelchair until she passed away, which was a year ago in February. But 8 months before my mother died, I hurt my shoulder and I had to go to physical therapy. And the physical therapy people asked me to try Pilates there. And I know this is an outside issue, but this is my inspiration to come back to OA happened lying on a Pilates machine. I was at least 232 pounds. It's a very kind person that was the teacher. and very accepting of me, and I realized I could move, and I realized how much I missed being able to move my body, and it made it just, I had a spiritual experience, which to me is remembering that I had the ability to love myself. Because for me, this disease is about self-hatred. You know, it's about self-hatred, it's about, you know, saying yes to everybody and putting myself last. And that is why I eat. I mean, there's no, you know, and what that manifests is a lot of anger all the time, of course, because you're always angry at the people that you're taking care of. So in order to push that down and be a very good girl, which I was, you know, from the time I was born, I was a really good child. In order to stay like that, I had to eat all the time. And I had gotten to the point where I was eating round the clock. I was eating in my car. The only thing I never broke from my first abstinence was I never ate in bed again. And I even forgot the other thing, but it doesn't matter because I gained 83 pounds, which since I started the new abstinence, which is 2 years and 2 months ago, I've lost 83 pounds. And this time, at 58 years old, I know that it's not all about being thin, because there is, you know, I mean, that definitely helps. There's no question about it. I mean, I feel very relieved that I got this abstinence back, because I had given up. I thought that this was it. I thought it was over. I thought I was going to just creep my way up to over 300 pounds. I felt that way. I felt hopeless. But being able to move on this Pilates machine, the next weekend after that, I went back to my first OA meeting, which is now my home group in Venice on Saturday mornings. And I walked in the door and got struck abstinence again. And I mean, I say struck, but the truth is that, you know, I wanted to come back and do it, but I cannot do this alone. That is, you know, to me, that's step one. I do not believe in a traditional God, because I don't think there's a God that gives somebody parking spaces when they're good and takes them away when they're bad. It just doesn't work that way for me, you know. It's about something interior that we all have and we're all connected to, and it's about self-love. You know, I went back to that group, and my bottom line is I don't miss that meeting no matter what. Unless I'm, you know, really sick and I don't want to give it to somebody else. But even when I'm sick, I'd like to be there. That's how much it means to me. You know, this is a group that, you know, it's 5 minutes from my house. It's on a Saturday morning at a time when I normally would not have gotten up. And, you know, it's, to me, this program is a miracle, because I don't think anybody can do this alone. You know, I watch these weight loss reality shows, first of all, and I think, what are they doing to these people? They're going to hurt them. You know, seriously. Exercise is a really, really big part of my recovery for a lot of reasons. And one is because I have heart disease in my family, and I don't want to follow in everybody else's footsteps. And then the next part of my story is that I had to figure out an abstinence that worked for me, a food plan that worked for me, because it was going to have to be a lifestyle change and not a diet. You know, I had to do something that was not going to make me feel like I was restricting, that I could take with me, whether it was on a holiday or in my everyday life. So, you know, I'm not going to explain exactly what it is, but I'll tell you that it's 3 meals a day and 2 optional snacks, and that I do not eat white flour, because I could sit in my car and eat more than 1 loaf of bread on my way to an appointment, you know, and with my hands, stuffing it in my mouth. And, you know, it's just not okay for me. That's something I learned to live without and enjoy my life. The choice that day, when I decided to come back to program, was a choice where I wanted to live. I wanted life more than I wanted to die, because really, when I was eating like that, I really wanted to die. Of course, I wanted my mother to die worse, but, the fact that I got abstinent 8 months before she died also was an important part of my story, because I didn't have to believe that somebody else could take all my power away. I believe in personal power coming from self-love, and I think that, a lot of people have issues where they have, kids in the house or a husband that needs to have chips in the cupboard and all that stuff, and I think that's a similar situation, because I spent every single day with my mother, and as sick as she was, and she was so sick, she had lung cancer, heart disease, emphysema, she was in a wheelchair from spinal stenosis, and couldn't walk, and she always wanted to go to restaurants where she could get a martini, and I mean, every day. And I did this. I just allowed it to happen on a daily basis. Part of my story is that I've also been sober for 25 years. And obviously the food is my first choice, because it never occurred to me to do anything about alcohol or drugs during that whole period of time. You know, I started eating when I was six. I found the comfort in jars of food in the cupboard and a spoon when I was 6 years old, because it was very scary in my household. And, a lot of that scariness is still with me today, and I still have to work on it, because a traumatic childhood follows you through your life. And, part of the deal now is, I've been in recovery for 2 years and 2 months. I've been in therapy for all that time. I can't do it without that, personally. Because all stuff keeps coming up and keeps coming up. I'm just getting to the grieving over the time that I spent not taking care of myself. And this is now about making amends to myself for the time that I chose not to be here. And, it's very hard for me, because you wake up one morning 58 years old and you go, what am I supposed to do now? I don't want to be alone for the rest of my life, and I have absolutely no idea how to be in a relationship. And, I joined up with Match.com and all these things, and I just keep clicking them, deleting them anyway, because, it's just too scary. Today, the great thing today is, I'm so grateful for this program still being here. It's changed so much over the years, but thank God you're all still here, because, I tried other things, but nothing works like OA for me. This being able to go in and buy clothes that are not in the plus size department for the first time in 10 years, that's a fun thing to do, but it's certainly not the answer. The answer is that I get to work on myself, on my insides, on a daily basis, because I have the ability to be in touch with what's going on with myself. And one day at a time, I make that choice to not eat no matter what. And, if there's, when in doubt, leave it out. That's my other favorite thing. if I have to think about it for more than 2 minutes, then I'm not supposed to be eating it. And, I just stick to what works for me. And just glad that you're all here. Thank you.
That was Beverly W. And our last speaker is now John K. John will now qualify and share his experience with his relapse and recovery.
You're gonna We're I have Mike. No idea what you're talking about.
I'm John. I am a compulsive. Ben, did you get the record working? Right. This is the problem with having two comedians on any panel. It's not a good idea. Anyway, I am John. I'm a compulsive eater.
Hey, John.
Obviously, I don't want to go through my whole story today, but you know, I came into OA almost 30 years ago. It would be 30 years in October, and I've got a little over 15 years abstinence. And the fact that those two numbers aren't exactly congruent is part of why I'm on this panel. I guess I have 15 years of messing around, and it took me a long time to really understand what that was about. When I first came into OA, I came like as also been mentioned, ditto on almost everything everybody said, by the way. And I came over from another program, and I had also had food from the beginning. That was my first drug, and I got struck abstinent, like I've heard said here. I got the abstinence fairy hit me on the head. I was 26 years old. I had the metabolism of the hummingbird then and lost my weight instantly and thought it was so easy. Why is everybody having so many problems? And then got busy on a second career with the comedy stuff. And so I was working at a magazine during the day and doing comedy at night. Also, there wasn't any time for meetings. And the wonderful thing about this disease is it's really patient. It waited a good year of me not going to meetings. I was still, I had, that was the time, the old dignity of choice was right after Gray Sheep. And, I just had my wonderful little syllabus. I'm a great student, so I got my food plan. I'll follow everything. And, my story parallel Bill W's and Bill's story where he said he reached a point where he knew he couldn't do it anymore, yet he did anyway. And that was my story. And then when I came back, the arrogance of, oh, I don't see why everybody's having problems. Now, I'm the one slipping and sliding. And I remember finally at one point, this is on my first abstinence break, of saying, I don't get it. What I'm doing everything exactly the way I did it the first time, and it's not working. And every once in a while, a little thought pops into my head that, that sort of essentially sounds like every other thought, but what it says is so foreign that I think it's the voice of God. It said, maybe you didn't do it right the first time, And I thought about it. I didn't work a program. I had a sponsor when I first came in. He went out, and so I didn't bother because I'm in that other program. I know it all. I can read the book. I can read the literature. And the thing that had to change on that first one is I had to get willing to do whatever it took again, and I went and got his sponsor, and I did what worked for me in my first program, which is I came in and said, tell me what to do. You tell me to, go stand in a tutu on the middle of Pico, I'll do it. I just want to get abstinent. And that's what happened. I got a pretty decent abstinence. I was living back in outside of New York City, and I got married, and we ended up moving out here. I was going to be a great TV writer, and that's when the wheels really came off my abstinence. I had a number of years at that point of pretty good abstinence, and I got out here, and it just fell apart. And I was on this most, and like we said, it's hell. When you've been in program, when you've had abstinence, when it's been clean, you've had it working, and you know how it's supposed to work, it's 10 times more miserable than if you never had it to begin with. And I remember it wasn't like I was screwing around. I was the secretary of Artists and Abstinence in Hollywood. I had a sponsor. I was sponsoring. I was a delegate to the intergroup. I'm doing all this stuff, and yet I'm leaving the Artists and Abstinence meeting where I'm secretary, and I'm driving to the donut shop. And I'm leaving going, why am I doing this? It's not like I'm sentenced to OA. Over in the other program sometimes, they'll get sentenced to have to go to meetings. I don't have to do this if I don't want to. Why am I doing this? And, you talk about that cunning and baffling and just pitiful demoralization. I couldn't understand it. And for me, this went on for a while, and I was on sort of this sine wave of breaking my abstinence and getting it back. It was like, I'll start thinking about eating and going out, and then I'll go out. Now I'm going to start thinking about trying to get back. Now I got my abstinence back. Now I can obsess on the weight that I've gained during my break. And just about that time, the sine wave hit dead air again, I start the whole thing all over again. And it just, that went on for a while, and it's just the most miserable time of my life. And I know, I finally went to another program for a while that had a very definite food plan because I just couldn't get it together. But I also knew somewhere in here, the stuff was going to hit the fan. And I went and got I had been in therapy before. I got a new therapist, and I just, I was bound to determine to go to any lengths, and even then it took a while to get abstinent. But I did, and I knew there was something under the surface that had nothing to do with the food, and I stayed abstinent, and I kept going to therapy, and then one day in therapy, the huge thing that was an inch from my nose, but I couldn't see it, was I was in a marriage I didn't want to be in with a woman who really loved me, and I'm a people pleaser, and to have to tell someone who really loves me that I don't love them, I would rather do anything. And so I continually kept wheeling this huge extra thing, distraction between me and my real problem, which was the food. And then, somewhere in my head, when I'm ready, I'll take care of this real problem. But the real problem was the marriage, and that was something I didn't want to deal with. And for me, I love the phrase in program where they say, you want to find out what you're eating over, stop eating. And that's exactly, what happened with me. And I think there were three things, and, in retrospect, I'm a great analyst. That's what I do for a living now. The child of alcoholics become great analysts because you're always scanning the horizon, but I can never do it looking forward. I always have to do it looking backward in my case. There were a couple things. One thing was I just didn't really have a gut-level understanding of what was the disease. I would talk about it all the time, the disease this, the disease that, but I really didn't get what it was. The other thing was I really didn't understand what powerless meant for me when it came to the food. I certainly understood it with alcohol. I was one of those people who passed up that magic line where if I picked up one drink, I was off to the races. So I understood that there, but with the food, I had trouble with that. And I also wasn't doing all the work. I was the half measures, availed me nothing. And I couldn't see that at the time because it's this illusion that half measures do avail you something, And so, for me, I had to understand what the disease was. I had to understand the disease is that little voice in my head that's constantly trying to find the loopholes. It's constantly trying to figure things out. That whole first abstinence I had, I used to say at meetings I tried every diet before I came to OA and none of them worked, but the reality was they all worked once. They worked because I came in and said, tell me what the new diet is, and I'll follow it. But the trouble is I have a diseased addict brain that then after I give it up and try and get it back, I can't do it. And that's exactly why I think I had the textbook OA, pink cloud abstinence, everything was easy because it was just another one of those diets. And then when it wasn't, I had to do the work, and at that time I hadn't been willing to. And the other thing I just couldn't understand, how that disease worked for me. I love there's a wonderful woman in program who says, you can't fix a broken brain with a broken brain. And that was part of it. I want to figure this all out myself. I have a lifetime of, I've got a great brain, I should be able to figure everything out, and I can't. I need a higher power. And I need a hierarchy of higher powers. Because, I always joke that, so me and God can go into a closet and become convinced chocolate's a vegetable. I'll pray to God. No, God's only chocolate. But, if I have a hierarchy of higher powers, including a sponsor, people in program, and when I call my sponsor and say, I prayed and meditated and God told me chocolate's a vegetable, he's going to say, I don't think so. No. But I needed to be more accountable. I needed to not try and make this a self-study program, which I desperately tried to. I would have a series of what I used to call bullshit sponsors. And what a bullshit sponsor is, a bullshit sponsor is a sponsor you have so you can tell other people you have a sponsor, but you never actually really use that sponsor in any way, and that's what I had. And the other thing I needed to understand is, for me, my disease is that, I would constantly say, I got into the food again, I did this, I needed to start seeing it, no, my disease got me into the food again. My disease did these things, And it became a lot easier when I started to think of it as the disease coming at me. I can deal with things coming at me. But if I think, I'm just changing my mind after doing all this work, like I had a lot, I couldn't get it, a while back I quit getting the LA Times because I just wasn't reading it, right? I did that on a Friday. I didn't call on Monday and say, send me the LA Times again, but the disease is, I always say my disease is like the world's best salesman. The world's best salesman who's, just imagine it, likable and slick and, all the stuff, and knows exactly what to say to make the sale, and the salesman can read your mind. So no matter what you've got as the answer to the salesman, he knows what you're going to say and has the answer for you. And it was always, and go, and this is why you need to go eat, you know, or this is why you need to go break your abstinence again. And the trouble with that world's best salesman is, in addition to doing all that, as you're going into the food, it's going, he goes, psst, and you know, this was your idea. And that makes it my idea, and I take on the guilt. Instead of being able to see, no, this is my disease is always going to keep whispering for me to not, to do whatever it can, to kick the can down the road. I know when I was in the middle of my slip, I would, well, I'm going to work on the spiritual part of the program right now. I'm going to do anything other than having to deal with actually putting the food down, you know? And I've got this great brain that can complicate a one, you know, one-step process. My disease grabs a hold of that and, oh, yes, we'll work on this. And, you know, you need to analyze with, you know, all the stuff with your parents and all that. You know, anything to keep me from actually putting the food down. And, I just know that that's what it does. I remember going through at least a couple months of program. I'm praying to get willing to be abstinent, you know. And there was a woman one time, I think she was like a birthday party speaker or something, said, you know, when it comes to addiction, willingness is highly overrated. You know, if Dr. Bob and Bill had waited until they were willing to get sober, we wouldn't have a program. You know, we wouldn't have a program because the thing that Dr. Bob and Bill had was pain. They had, it's funny, I just wrote this article for a website about the differences in the diseases, and I said, the thing about these other, you know, addictions is they have acute pain, and the acute pain sometimes slams you face down, but it gets your attention, and you go, oh my God, what am I doing? And the trouble with the food is it's a very dull, chronic pain that makes you just uncomfortable enough to know you should do something about it, but not uncomfortable enough to be willing to go to any lengths to do it. You know, I've told the story about the frog that you take a frog and put it toward a pan of boiling water. A frog's actually not dumb. It will start to try and get away because it knows it doesn't want anything to do with that. But you can take that same frog and put it in a pan of room temperature water and slowly turn up the heat, and that frog will never jump out and will die in there. And to me, that's the perfect analogy of this disease. It's just that slow thing, and if you're smart, you keep moving the goalpost, you keep only looking, in the mirror from here up, and making, you know, we constantly, you know, accept what was previously unacceptable. And that's the problem with this disease. You know, I think... The other thing that the real aha moment for me, of course, came after the fact, was I didn't understand powerlessness. I would 15 years of going to meetings, I'm powerless over food, I'm powerless, powerless, powerless. I'll say it to me, you're powerless, 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 and I'm going to eat. And I'm powerless, powerless, eat, powerless, powerless, eat. You know, if I really thought I was powerless, would I be, you know, I mean, I always say, you know, I believe I'm powerless over a bullet and a gun. Because I've never put a gun to my head, and as I'm pulling the trigger, say, oh, I'll start again on Monday. You know, I get that's it, but yet I would do that. And part of the reason was I had broken my abstinence and gotten it back over and over and over for 15 years. So no matter what I'm saying, no matter what these things in the book say, I've got the empirical evidence that I am powerful over the food. Because I've broken my abstinence, and I've gotten it back. And what I needed to do is I needed to change my perspective on what powerlessness meant for me and the food. I am powerful over food in the small picture, in the micro, but I am powerless in the big picture. And I'm, for me, you know, in the old days, when people have been around for a while, you always used to hear, you know, we don't eat no matter what, you know. I heard somebody say it much better. They said, you know, if you're a compulsive eater and food is become an option, it'll always be the only option. It's always going to be the path of least resistance. Who's going to want to have to choose between emotional pain or eating something that you A, like the taste of, and B, at least at one point in your life, worked for you? And for me, my concept of powerless had this change to be, food can't be an option for emotional stuff. It's my fuel, I have to do it, but it can't be an option. And I also have to look at specific foods for me that are a problem. And the other thing is I wasn't doing all the work. You know, I think I heard somebody a lot that long ago say that in her first abstinence she worked the tools and this time she works the steps. And I understand that. For me, the tools are sort of an adjunct for the first three steps. They can help you get your abstinence and you do all that work. But for me, the people I've seen who've gone out after a certain amount of time, they stopped at three. They didn't do all the extra work, you know. And to me, that's like, it's like if you do those first three steps, you bolted the front door and the back door, but you've left the windows open, you know. And for me, I needed to change that. And I needed to do all of that work. The other thing I'll just say real quick, because I got to wrap up, is you know, this is not part of my experience per se, but I've seen a lot, this article I just wrote, I talked about how the one extra thing compulsive eating has that other addictions don't, is how intricately, for some people, it's intertwined with sexuality. And especially young women. And, you know, I got abstinent. I was a guy. I had no sisters. I was clueless. I don't know what kind of signals were out there. But young, especially women, they don't have that. And you have to deal with becoming attractive and attention. And then the whole idea of then having to deal with getting in a relationship and having to deal with that. And, you know, and this is like a whole extra thing there. And I don't know for everybody, you know, I can only speak for myself. The problem I was having when I was dealing with my bad slip was I was fighting myself, you know. And I know that only from looking at the symptoms, that I'd be abstinent and lose it and be abstinent and lose it, that there was a part of me that desperately wanted it and a part of me that was desperately afraid of it. And for me, it's been said here before, but I'm a huge believer in outside help. You know, my sponsor was able to help me to a certain extent, but I needed some professional help to work through that. And especially with the stuff that was going on. So anyway, that's my story. Thanks.
That was John Kay. And to briefly qualify for myself, when I came to this program, it was about 16 years ago, and I was 400 pounds. And now I have 5 years, 5 months, and 1 day abstinence. So please remember, the stories that you hear here today is about relapse and recovery. There is hope for all of us. If you go out and binge, there will be tomorrow. Elway will always be here. It's your choice if you want to be here or not. So we will now take a 5-minute break before beginning the next portion of the workshop. There are paper and pencils on the table. Please take a moment when writing out your questions and bring them back. And thank you all. We'll see you in just 5 minutes.
Yeah.